welcome to Sarah's Bookshelves Live. I'm Sarah of the blog Sarah's Bookshelves. Each week, I'm talking with one bookish guest about two old books they love, two new books they love, one book they don't love, and one new release they're excited about. We're going to get real and sometimes a bit snarky about all things books. If you like the show, I'd really love your support. Spread the word to your reader friends, subscribe to the show, rate and review it wherever you listen to podcasts, or get bonus podcast episodes by supporting the podcast on Patreon. There's a link in the show notes and in my Instagram bio to my Patreon page. Let's get rolling. Hey, everyone. Welcome to a full-length episode of Sarah's Bookshelves Live. Today, we're going to be talking about libraries and how the coronavirus pandemic has impacted libraries. My guest is Kelly Jensen, who has been writing about libraries during coronavirus for BookRiot.com, and she recently surveyed libraries about how they've been handling the pandemic, their reopening plans, and how they will support virtual learning this fall. And we're going to discuss those survey results, among other things. Kelly is a former librarian and a longtime blogger at Stacked. She's the editor-author of Don't Call Me Crazy, 33 Voices Start the Conversation About Mental Health, and the editor-author of Here We Are, Feminism in the Real World. She's the host of the Hey YA podcast at Book Riot, and many of her book recommendations today will be YA. And her latest book, Body Talk, came out August 18th. Welcome, Kelly.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for being here. I have been talking in the podcast Facebook group about doing an episode around libraries and COVID for quite a while now. So I'm really excited to have you here. And I was really excited when I heard Jeff O'Neill and Rebecca Shinsky mention the survey you were doing on the Book Riot podcast, which is how I sort of got led to you.
Yeah, I'm a former librarian. So it's always been one of those topics that's close to my heart. And I think that there has been a lot of ink shed talking to administrators and people who are making decisions in libraries, and not so much from those who are working, you know, on the floor and working with other people. And so much of my, and I should say all of the work I try to do puts those frontline workers front and center. I give them an opportunity to share their insights as well as their concerns, the things they're excited about, and do so in a way that allows them, if necessary, to be anonymous, which I know that there's some fear about something happening to their jobs or their security in their jobs if they use their name sometimes. So this has been an opportunity to like get the real inside scoop.
Absolutely. And as you're talking, I'm sitting here kind of doing an analogy in my head about schools as well, like the administration and then the teachers on the ground and the anonymous aspect as well.
Mm-hmm.
So as a former librarian, can you tell us a bit about the many roles that libraries fill aside from just lending books in non-pandemic times? Because I know personally, I think of a library as a library patron. I think of a library and I think of, oh, that's where I borrow books and ebooks, et cetera. But there's so much more that they do.
There is. But I think there is this perception that libraries have to be more than that. And for, you know, decades, they have fulfilled the role of many other places. But the heart and soul of the public library is material lending, so books, audiobooks. But beyond that, other core services that you can find at the public library include programming. So that's anything from story time with babies, story time with preschoolers, to running adult craft programs, to informational programming. So some libraries will offer, like, tax experts will come in and talk about, you know, how to do your taxes or how to get the information you need for your taxes. A number will offer tutoring opportunities or offer programs on things like financial stability, financial management. So that's a big piece of contemporary libraries. And then in addition to that, we have access to technology and the internet. And I'm talking literally like access to a computer with typing program, access to a printer, access to fax machines, to scanners, to other types of technology that a particular library might have that a patron can utilize at the library or may be able to borrow it. So I worked at a library when e-readers were first starting to become more available, and we made e-readers a thing you could check out for a period of time.
Oh, interesting.
Like, what a cool service.
Yeah, absolutely.
So other things, there's outreach. So I always think of outreach as the bookmobile is a great, easy example, is the library leaves the building and offers their services somewhere else in the community. There's the fact that a library is also this third space for studying, for meeting, and it's one of the few places that you can go into and there's zero expectation of needing to make a purchase or do anything. You could literally go in the library and just hang out in the library for, you know, an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, and like nobody expects anything of you at that time. So I like to emphasize this again, books, materials, bread and butter, but then there are these other services that, unless the patron takes advantage of them, might not be as familiar with.
Gotcha. And we'll get to this in a minute, but I'm thinking kind of a lot of these other services have been heavily impacted by COVID.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about the survey you did. What were you looking to learn? What were your biggest takeaways, trends that you saw, anything that really jumped out and surprised you that you were not expecting?
Sure. I have done a couple of surveys this year, but the most recent one was specifically on how public libraries were going to handle school this year, this fall, because so many schools were going to the last minute to decide how they were going to provide education, be it in-person, hybrid, virtual, which left everybody waiting and waiting and waiting. And this included public libraries that, I won't say this is universal, but typically libraries follow in school scheduling. So during the school year, often if they're open Sundays, that's when they'll be open on Sundays so that young people have access to the library two times on the weekend. And their hours are a little bit longer during the week. You know, they might be open 9 to 8, 9 to 9. But with the pandemic, so many hours shifted. It got me thinking a lot about how they were going to fill the role of helping students at this point, because how are students going to access materials that they need, particularly if they are virtual and don't have access to a school library? They're going to have to find their materials somewhere, somehow. So I was curious what they were doing or discussing in terms of like where they are able to fill in the gap. And so the goal was really to look at the what's, the ifs, and the hows of libraries and how they would play a role in the new school year. And so my biggest takeaway in this, I think I had about 40 responses, and I just passed it via social media and again made it one of those things that could be anonymous, that folks didn't have to share any identifying information. I made that spreadsheet accessible to anyone who was interested and got rid of like any potentially identifying information.
And y'all, I will link to Kelly's article that she wrote for bookriot.com about the survey, and that links to the actual spreadsheet data if you're interested in seeing that. So I'll link to that in the show notes for you.
And so my big takeaway, now know that I did this in early August, and the piece came out at the end of August, I believe.
Yes.
The biggest takeaway was that nobody knows. Everything is so day by day right now, and understandably so. Thinking ahead, particularly in that time frame when even the schools didn't have a solid answer, trying to come up with a plan was so challenging. And I'm really lucky because I have a great relationship with my own local library. And so I got a little insight into what they were doing. And I also got some, I don't want to say firsthand knowledge, but like it's been really interesting to see what they were saying in August versus what they're actually doing now and seeing how they're adapting. So they, for example, offer a time frame, I want to say every day of the week, but it might not be, that just students can use the library space for virtual learning. You know, it's like from 8 to 10 in the morning, they can be there for virtual learning. It's been interesting to see what they're doing as it pops up, because nobody could guess what it was going to look like. And the reality is library staff, doesn't matter if they're frontline librarians doing, you know, quote unquote librarian work, or they're folks who are doing the support services, they are so stressed out. And so many of them feel completely alone and like they don't have support for themselves or their needs. And this was such a big reality before COVID.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
It's only gotten worse. So many have become like mask police instead of doing what they really wish to be doing in the library. And that is taking a mental toll on top of the fact like we're in a pandemic. They're worried about their own health and the health of their community, the health of their family. It's been interesting to see that shift in their experiences through these last couple of surveys I've done. And I've heard librarians, particularly those who work in programming and especially those who work with kids, that a lot of them are wondering what their job really is and whether or not it's something they even want to continue doing if they're not working with people. Because virtual story time is awesome. It gives access, you know, but it's not story time. It's something completely different. And as virtual programming continues to be a reality, it's not necessarily well attended. I think we can agree if we've attended any virtual programming at all, attendance is all over the place.
For me, I think of the virtual programming that first comes to mind for me is like virtual book tours and Instagram lives with authors and all that stuff that are going through independent bookstores. And there, I feel like there's been so just many things that I no longer can differentiate. It's just so cluttered that I just check out.
Yeah. And I can tell you as an author who did that, I feel similarly. And also just like it's exhausting to promote it because you know that there's such an abundance of this. And how do you separate your virtual program from another virtual program? It's challenging, you know, and one of the comments I wrote down was like, aren't you tired of Zoom meetings? Because patrons are too. It's like, you know, like we joke about it, but it's a reality.
So do you hear from librarians that are they kind of adjusting to this and like did a lot of the virtual programming out of the gates, seeing that it's not very well attended and are now kind of going to pivot to something different?
I think that they're just trying and some things are working, some things aren't working. And it really depends library to library. Like I know some libraries had programming all summer long to go with summer reading. But then when fall started back, we're like, yeah, it wasn't worth the time and energy to do that. Whereas other libraries, they're getting pressure from administration to offer X number of programs. So they're still continuing, even though it's not necessarily meeting the numbers that they're used to meeting or having the same sort of reception that they have come to know from their community. You'd asked, I think, too, about books being borrowed. Like, has that changed at all?
Yeah, like trends you're seeing in types of books being checked out.
I don't know an answer to this.
Yeah.
But what I
figured that might be a little bit out of the wheelhouse of this particular topic. But
and I think that it's still too soon maybe for libraries to know. But I do know that one of the things I've seen requests for and one of the things that librarians have been doing is creating like book bundles on themes or certain authors or genres so that.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, it's brilliant. Patrons then don't have to come in and browse, but can instead just like pick up a bundle of books by, I don't know, Beverly Cleary, right? Or, you know, they love mysteries. So the library puts together, you know, two new mysteries, three old ones, and they can check out that bundle. Then they don't have to go in the library and browse. Instead, it's done for them. And I've seen particularly parents really loving this because then they don't have to drag kids in the library either.
Absolutely.
One less stressful thing. And I think that we'll continue to see that kind of innovation. And I think that that helps both the library. It saves time, it saves energy, and it allows them to like put their knowledge to work. But it also is a great service to patrons who then don't have to go in and don't have to spend that extra time when they're already running on such low like brain energy capacity.
Yes. And was there anything in the survey results that really just shocked you that you just were not expecting to see?
Not really. I guess the answer is I saw fewer responses about layoffs and furloughs than I thought I would. But that,
yes,
that could be simply a matter of who responded. And, you know, folks who are in that position may not be interested in answering a survey about library work, which totally fair. And that's, I think, one of the big challenges, too, in trying to offer any innovative services right now when doing the bare minimum is hard enough when half your staff is gone. It's now an issue of like actual human energy and time and the money to make these things happen.
That makes sense. So on the creative front, what are some of the creative things you've seen libraries do during this time to adjust to this environment?
They're offering homeschool materials. That one popped up a few times in terms of like making sure there's resources for new homeschooling families, be it like an actual homeschool curriculum that they're doing or materials for parents who are like doing this for the first time and trying to make it work. The other big thing I've seen, and my library just started doing this, I think it's great, is just getting rid of fines. And going fine free has been a thing for a while, but this is not necessarily in that same vein. This is more like due dates have changed so much that it's gotten confusing, you know, because when people went into lockdown, like due dates went out 3 months, 4 months. But now that there's more and more research about how long the virus can live on materials, it's like some stuff is sitting, being decontaminated for up to 7 days. And so like my library is like, we can't handle the due dates like this anymore. And it doesn't seem fair to put that onus on patrons either. So, you know, going fine free is huge. It helps just in so many ways. And it further encourages, I think, those who might be reluctant to go to the library for any reason related to money or fines to maybe revisit the library.
At this point, libraries still are sort of quarantining physical books in between lens.
Yes. There was just a new report from the organization that's doing the testing on materials that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. It was originally, I want to say, 48 or 72 hours. I can't remember which one was like the original time frame. And they did a reevaluation and now it's a week. So materials are sometimes sitting. Like I know my system is doing a week. Materials have to be out and flat and quarantined for a week before they can go to the next person. So
this is interesting because I had originally in the beginning of this been, you know, if I ordered a package and I would let it sit out on my front steps for a couple days before I brought it in. And then I started reading stuff that wasn't necessary and like decontaminating all your groceries weren't necessary. And now it sounds like this is the opposite.
I think it's different for books though.
Oh, okay.
Because books are porous. They're made of paper and like, who knows what can stick to it. It's different than, you know, a package would be. And I wish I can give you the information like off the top of my head. I can look it up and send you the link for the group that's doing all this research for library materials specifically.
And I can put that in the show notes, y'all, too. So can you tell us also a little bit about how librarians themselves are sort of being repurposed to fill different types of roles during this pandemic? I know there have been a couple big articles that have come out about, for example, librarians being used as contact tracers because they are good with data and research.
Yeah, I wrote a couple of these pieces. So contact tracing is a big one. Another big one, this one was particularly in Phoenix for a while. I don't know if it's still the case, but they were doing a lot of the logistics for COVID testing. So they were not necessarily doing the COVID testing, but helping coordinate the whole logistical flow of how people would, you know, fill out the paperwork and then wait in line. And I know folks in other library systems that were working in different departments across the city in, you know, it could be things as simple as working in a parking lot and helping people figure out where to park. But recently, the thing that I have seen popping up and that is extremely dangerous and short-sighted is there are a number of facilities that have become childcare facilities. And it's really frustrating to watch that because libraries have a purpose and they don't need to be repurposed as childcare facilities. Like if childcare centers and schools aren't open because of safety, why is it okay for libraries to become that? And
so they're like becoming daycare centers or?
Yes, they're using the space for childcare. And this kind of leads back to an earlier point I made, which is that libraries have become this catch-all. And for so long, libraries were really proud of like being able to offer so much. But now I think it's coming back to bite them. In that like, oh, they don't have this specific purpose that they're really focused on. Instead, they can be anything to anyone. And, you know, if they can do it all, why don't they do it all? And it comes back to like, why are you putting people who are not trained to do this in these roles?
And are they staffed by the librarians or by the library staff?
Both, I believe. Yes.
You know, I hadn't heard that libraries were doing it, but lots of organizations in my area are offering these types of services for, you know, families that all of a sudden don't have, they got to go to work and their children are not in school and they don't necessarily have the money for, you know, full childcare. So they're really left between a rock and a hard place. And a lot of different organizations have been repurposing themselves to support some of these families.
Which is great. Like, I'm grateful and I'm sure all parents are grateful for that. But I think that really points to the bigger issue that we do not have the social safety nets that we need to be having. And the fact that it's falling on other organizations to handle is a problem that needs to be addressed on a much bigger level, which I really wish we were having those conversations, but we're not. We're just finding makeshift solutions and hoping that, you know, this just goes away and that we don't actually have to deal with the bigger challenges.
Yeah, I think, you know, many people have been left to sort of figure it out themselves these days.
Yeah, which is not fair for anybody.
No. So I guess this is an if question, a what and an if question. Mm-hmm. Are there any impacts of COVID that, and this is an opinion as well, that you foresee, you know, we're not really focused on right now, but they might be big icebergs down the line as far as the impacts to libraries and things that have ripple effects for years moving forward?
Yeah. The big one is going to be budget issues. And I think that we're going to start to see the realities of that when it comes to public services like schools and libraries in ways that people are only focused on small businesses right now, which fair, okay? But that same reality of people being out of work, being unable to pay their taxes is going to have a ripple effect on public services. And libraries are already working on shoestring budgets. Like, if you saw the budgets of libraries, you would be just shocked how much they're getting done for literally pennies. And now it's going to get so much worse because staff reductions are happening. Limits on time in libraries are happening, and that's a budget issue. We're going to see materials be fewer and farther between because budgets. And it all comes down to budgets and what is available to them.
So on the topic of budgets, is there sort of a usual progression of what gets cut first?
That's a good question. And it's going to depend on each community and what the budget looks like. Staff doesn't make a lot of money. So we'll start with that. Most librarians do not make a lot of money. So cutting from staff budgets pretty much means cutting staff. And so I think that tends to be a last resort. But so is cutting materials, because literally your job as a librarian is to be the steward of your public money. And so you want to be able to provide the resources and materials to your community that they're expecting. So it's hard. It's a lot of, okay, so we have statistics that tell us programming from this time to this time isn't as popular as this time to this time. We're going to cut that budget. And that might not be a huge amount, but like, it might get the job done. So it's tough. There's not a good answer to that one. It's, you know, like any other public service, you're going to sit down and make really tough decisions.
And let's say there's patrons that just use the library to borrow books or ebooks or audiobooks.
Yeah.
Do the budget cuts impact the selection of the books they have available to them, how many copies they have available to them, therefore, which translate to the wait times on the hold list?
Depending on what they're looking for, depending where the budget cuts happen, it could mean that their library doesn't buy 6 copies of whatever the big title is, but buys 3 copies and then has to rely on those 3 copies plus whatever is available throughout the rest of the library system, if there's a system that they're part of. And then that's shared resources with how many other communities that are doing the same thing. So it's really hard to say. What I can say is that ebooks and audiobooks are and have been a huge challenge since they started. And I think that
interesting. Why is that?
They're so expensive.
Oh, yeah, that I literally just wrote down in my notes, are ebooks cheaper than print books for the library to acquire? Okay, so that's the answer.
No. And in fact, I am going to link you to a piece from Jennifer Rothschild. He's been doing work on this. So purchasing, quote unquote, I'm using quotes there, an ebook or e-audiobook from a vendor, because you do it through a vendor.
Okay.
Means you're buying a license. You are not buying the title. And that license is going to depend on each publisher. So a publisher can say you have a 2-year license on titles, which means after 2 years, you have to buy it again if you want that to stay in your collection.
Yes.
And the cost to even get that first license is astronomical.
Like, give me a ballpark of a cost to get a license of a book that most people would want to check out. Maybe not the biggest bestseller in the world, but.
Yeah. So let's look at the average. This is from Jennifer's piece. I'm just going to read it.
Sure. And I'll link to this, y'all, in the show notes.
Let's look at the averages for print, digital book, and digital audio. Okay. So on average, the suggested retail price for a print book, aka the price that's on the cover, was $24.78. So we'll say $25. On average, Amazon would sell you as a regular reader, not as a library, a copy of that book in print for about $17. And your library, going through a vendor, typically pays about $14, $15. So print books through vendors for libraries tend to have a nice discount to them. And as you know, it's a print book. So yes, there's wear tear, there's needing to replace it, but you're not limited to 2 years. You're not limited to a certain number of borrows.
Oh, okay.
So then digitally, you could buy that same book for, let's say, $13 on Kindle. Okay. The library would have to pay $46 for that.
What?
Yeah. So on average, your library is paying 3.5 more times for your ebook than you are to buy it. And that means libraries can buy 3 print copies for every single ebook license and still have money left over.
Wow.
So then, wait, there's audio.
Yes.
So the average price to buy a book on Audible, let's say it's $27, okay? For libraries, $70.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay, I feel like a terrible library patron because I really prefer to read digitally. So I literally have never checked out a print book from my library. I check out ebooks from Libby and audiobooks from Libby. So would I be doing my library a favor if I switched over to print, or does that not matter?
I don't think it matters.
Okay.
I think that the real thing would be advocating for libraries to have fair pricing on these, in part because you are such an avid user of them.
Right. Well, and during COVID, I'm sure that usage of ebooks and audiobooks went up considerably.
Yes, I can't remember the number my library cited, but I want to say it was like 65% increase in,
right,
you know, the 3 months, which is bananas.
I mean, anyone that has been on a hold list since COVID started, you feel it for an ebook or an audiobook.
Yeah. How libraries buy their e-material differs. Some places, I don't know if this is still the case. I think it might be, but when I worked in Wisconsin, it was a statewide system, meaning that you could get better prices by being part of the statewide consortium, but you were also sharing with the state. So, you know, you could have 10 copies of the latest James Patterson in ebook, but you're sharing those 10 copies with 300 libraries. So your wait could be a long time. Jennifer notes in her analysis that 86% of the ebooks have to be repurchased on a regular basis, typically after 24 months, even if the book is never checked out.
Oh, Lord. Okay.
Yeah. So when you start doing the math of that, it's like, holy cow, they're paying so much more for ebooks that they don't even get to keep.
So did you hear, and I feel like I heard this somewhere, but I can't remember off the top of my head where, whether it was a podcast, maybe even Book Riot's podcast. I get a lot of my publishing news from that because it's, you know, a nice, easy Monday morning hour and gets me what I need. Did any publishers change the terms of their licensing with libraries during COVID as like a current?
Yes.
Okay.
I would say it was a courtesy, though. So Macmillan, and I wrote about this, you can pull up the link on Book Riot, Macmillan had changed the terms of their ebook system. And off the top of my head, I can't remember, but...
It was a big scandal.
Yes, because it limited new books to, I can't remember, you couldn't get the ebook license for 8 weeks after it came out.
It was sort of like the equivalent of old school back when Blockbuster existed. Movies, you couldn't get them in the Blockbuster for a certain number of amount of time after they'd been in theaters. It was like the equivalent of that for books.
Yes. And basically the CEO of Macmillan's like, well, you know, libraries, they're taking away the I can't remember how he said it, but he made it sound like, you know, libraries are the reason those aren't as profitable as they could be and blah, 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 blah. But then, of course, during the pandemic, Macmillan changed course because, shocker, do you know where libraries spend money? On ebooks. Do you know how patrons discover new authors and new books, particularly those midlist titles? It's through libraries. So it's just funny, I put that in quotations, that it was a global pandemic that made it clear how vital libraries were for publishers. And so, yeah, that one changed. And I don't think anybody was surprised that they backstepped that. I think, though, that it happened during the pandemic was maybe what was a little bit like, you know, surprising, but at the same time, like, we were waiting for it to happen.
Do you think they used the pandemic as a way, a face-saving way to walk back what they later discovered was a policy that everyone really hated?
It's possible. I can't say.
Yeah, sure. Obviously, this is your opinion. Yeah. Okay, let's see. There's a just a couple random listener questions that I wanted to throw out, and maybe you know the answers, maybe you don't, but I did tell listeners that I was having, you know, somebody come on to talk about libraries. Do you know if libraries in general, and this is a huge generalization, obviously, but did they go ahead and acquire more ebooks and audiobooks during COVID, knowing that there was going to be more of a demand, or is that not even possible with how libraries work?
It's challenging because some libraries may have been able to move budgets around, others may not have been. It depends on the library. It depends on how challenging it is to change a budget, to shift things around. It's also possible that libraries which have their budgets shift mid-year, so, you know, June 30th is the fiscal year and then July 1st starts the next one. It's possible that libraries who saw what was happening were able to change things around there. But again, because of how expensive digital materials are, it's also possible libraries were like, we're not going to use our small budgets this way. But it's also possible some of them did stock up on titles that were especially popular. Like I would venture to guess that they may have purchased more anti-racism titles specifically because there was such demand in them and demand in a virtual capacity. That would be my guess.
And do you think that COVID will change over the longer term, sort of the libraries' breakdown of how much funding they use to spend on print books versus digital? And I'm lumping audio into that digital.
No. I think that the issue is money, as I've talked about before. That's a big deal. And why would libraries see it as useful to spend so much on so little that doesn't give access to everybody? The reality is there's still a very real digital divide too. And not everybody has a device or the internet. And this is part of why virtual schooling has been such an issue. So like I mentioned before, my local library was offering Wi-Fi from the parking lot for those who don't have it, because we have quite a big rural community and these places do not get reliable internet. So how are they supposed to do their work? How are they supposed to do school? They have to go somewhere where there is a reliable internet. And that impacts digital materials as well. Whereas a library can go and drop off materials in more rural places, those folks need to find a way to get to the library to have access to any of their digital materials. I think too, just in a world of budget cuts, it's not going to be realistic with the way that pricing works right now. There might be, as I mentioned before, some shifting to purchasing more high demand titles in larger quantities, but I don't know. I don't think it'll ship that much. I could be wrong, but yeah, you know.
I think probably nobody knows right now. I mean.
Right. And I think it's going to depend too where you're at, because a good public library serves its patrons. So if you're in an area where everybody's got devices and uses their devices, that might be different than an area where I'm at where that's not the case. So yeah, it's hard to say.
All right. One last thing before we get to your book recommendations. Can you tell us a little bit about your book that just came out August 18th?
Yes. So it's Body Talk, 37 Voices Explore Our Radical Anatomy. And it's an anthology all about the political and physical aspects of having a human body. It's essays and art and comics and lists that are these really raw and vulnerable and real. And also many of them are funny pieces about living in a body. So there's just about any kind of bodily experience you can imagine. Everything from scoliosis to being deaf to the thing that was really important to me to cover, reproductive issues that don't appear a lot, particularly in young adult literature, where a lot of these issues start to emerge. My goal was just having this incredible resource for young people as well as not so young people to be like, oh, all the things that are weird about my body are weird, sure, but also I'm not the only one who thinks I have a weird body, or that like this quirky thing about my body or this different thing about my body, like it makes my body unique. And that is the whole point of having a body, is it's meant to be different and unique. And I don't want to call it a body positive book because I don't think it is, but positivity does come through in many of the pieces.
I love that you did this, because I look back on like my time as a middle school girl, and Everybody, no matter what you look like, everybody hates what they look like. Yep. And everybody's just so insecure about stuff. And I think having this kind of resource out there is great.
Yeah. And I wanted to give people like insights into what others are thinking about their own body, because we only know what we think about ours. And it's like, you start reading these pieces and some of them are by folks like, you know, that I would look at even now as an adult. I'm like, my goodness, like I would give anything to look like you. And then you hear their stories and you're like, oh yeah, they're much more complex than literally what you see on the surface. And that's the whole point, is we are such complex beings. And so it was really cool to be able to put this together. Like, this is my dream body book. So,
and especially in the age of Instagram too, As these kids are growing up in this world, which I did not grow up in, and I can't imagine having grown up in. No.
Yeah. I think about that all the time. I'm like, I'm so glad that it was just AOL Instant Messenger when I was growing up.
We didn't even have that. I'm older than you. All right, let's get to your book recommendations. Oh, and y'all, I will link to Kelly's book in the show notes. So if you're interested in purchasing, please do that. All right, let's get to your book recommendations. And most of these are YA, y'all, because Kelly hosts a podcast called Hey YA and obviously reads lots of YA. And if you're a new listener, if you're an old listener, you know I do not read a lot of YA. If you're a new listener, I'm telling you now. So this is going to be a lot of, you know, new stuff for me as well. So I'm looking forward to hearing about it. Tell me about the first old book you love.
The Side of Home by Renee Watson. It is the story of twin sisters living in Portland, Oregon, who are grappling with the realities of their community being gentrified in two very different ways. It's a brilliant book by a brilliant writer that explores a really complex issue. And I just, Renee Watson is writing some of the best YA out there. And this one of her earlier ones, I think, isn't read quite as widely as her others.
Sure. And this is a twins book too, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And sort of each twin has a different opinion about what's going on in their neighborhood. I like that dynamic.
Yeah, it's great because it gives you both perspectives of like one twin who loves the gentrification of it and one who sees why it's such a problem for their community. And it's a nice balance of the perspectives.
That's The Side of Home by Renee Watson, and that came out in 2015. Tell me about the second old book you love.
Far From You by Tess Sharp. I just reread this book this year and loved it even more than I did the first time I read it. It's a really great comp for Veronica Mars, for people who love that show. And it It stars, like, it might be the closest comp I've ever read. I see that comp all the time. Most of the time I'm like, not really, but this one, yes. It stars a bisexual teen girl who is trying to figure out who killed her best friend while struggling with people who don't want to believe her or what she's saying or discovering because of her own challenging history. It's dark and twisty, and it's very much a mystery.
I saw when I was researching this, LGBTQ romance. Is that spoilery of me to say that?
No, not at all.
No? Okay.
It's not, and I think that that's a pretty important thing to actually bring up with this one, because this is one of the first early YA book, early. I mean, it's really not that old, which I think tells you something, but one of the first to use the word bisexual.
Really?
On the page.
Okay.
Yeah. And so it's an important part of the story.
Sure. So what I saw was LGBTQ romance / murder mystery / coming of age / addiction. I was like, yes. Wow, that's a lot. And so it all works together, and it actually can handle all these things at one time.
Yes, brilliantly. And it's written in two different timelines too. So it's very, very savvy.
I have a question for you about, this is about a YA in general. I saw this book labeled in Edelweiss as juvenile fiction. Is that the same as YA? Is it the same as middle grade? Is it a totally different thing by itself? What is that?
It's going to depend, but like, I think about juvenile fiction in terms of how I used to have it in my library, which tends to be the fiction right before middle grade. So kind of like that step between early readers and middle grade, but it can sometimes include middle grade titles.
So like, what grade levels ballpark would that be?
I don't know, maybe second to fourth, fifth, something. In there, yeah.
My children. Hooray.
Yeah, there you go.
That was Far From You by Tess Sharp, came out in 2014. And tell me about the first new book you love. I've never heard of this book. I want to read it immediately. The title's amazing. Tell me about it.
Yes, it's My Eyes Are Up Here by Laura Zimmerman. And I actually wrote this really long post about this book at Book Riot because it got me so good. It's a book about a girl with giant boobs in high school.
Yes, I was one of those. It was awful.
Me too. And this is about the realities of that life, from things like never being able to fit in a sports uniform,
yeah,
to needing to find special sports bras to like contain one's greatness. It is so funny. And I related to this book so deeply as somebody who was that person in high school. And I just, throughout the whole thing, I was like, I have never painfully related to a book so much. And just also loved laughing. Like, that was such a nice, you know, not laughing at her, but she just has a very, very funny voice. And that brought up a lot of memories.
And she's a volleyball player. So this is a female athlete protagonist. Y'all know how much I love those. Yeah. And I played volleyball in high school. So literally everything about this book, I'm like, A, I wish it had been written when I was in school because I was so thoroughly embarrassed about my boobs. They grew early. When I was needing to wear a bra way before anyone else, I would try to hide the fact that I was wearing a bra. I would try to not wear it to school. And my mom was like, no, you have to wear it. And I was a swimmer, so I was on a pool deck in a bathing suit quite often, and I was hunched over trying to hide the boobs. I really, really need to read this book.
Mm-hmm, you do.
And I need to put it in my back pocket for my daughter, who I'm hoping is not going to be genetically like me, but she might probably will be. So
yeah. And like I said, I think the humor helps a lot because, yes, you're going to cringe, but at the same time, you're like, okay, but also like the way she phrases it is so, so funny. Like, this is reality, you know? And so why not laugh about it?
And I think it's so such a dichotomy, and maybe it tell me if it this book touches on this at all, that so many people go on to later in life get breast enhancements, and I was always one that wanted a reduction.
I don't remember if it touches on that, but I did, like, when I was writing about this book, it was fascinating to think about, because when you do hear about big boobs, so often the conversation is about reduction or, for those who don't have big boobs, enhancement. And I've always been a person who's like not interested in either of those things. And it was interesting to read a character who had big boobs, but like that was not the story of like, they're going to get bigger, they're going to get smaller. It's like, this is life right now.
Oh, that, okay. I kind of like that.
Yeah.
For that age. All right. That was My Eyes Are Up Here. Amazing title. by Laura Zimmerman, and that came out in June, and that will go on my TBR list. And we know how getting to every book on my TBR list goes. But anyway, when I need something light and funny, which is right now because I can't seem to concentrate on much of anything.
I feel that.
That might jump to the top of the list. All right. Tell me about the second new book you love.
So this one, I believe, came out in January, and it's called We Ride Upon Sticks by Quan Berry. And it is a total and utter delight that reminded me a lot of the movie Now and Then, which is like my favorite movie. And it's a story that follows a team of field hockey players in Danvers, Massachusetts, who believe that they're imbued with the power of witchcraft as bestowed upon them by Emilio Estevez. Yeah. As soon as you hear that, you're like, okay, I kind of know where this book is going. They were the worst field hockey team in the state. They discovered their powers during a field hockey camp. And then, lo and behold, they become the best in the state because of this belief that they have. And each of the main characters in the story tells one of the chapters from a third-person point of view. And then it all rounds back to the team revisiting one another on their hallowed ground 30 years later. It is inclusive. It is packed with late 80s pop culture references. And it is laugh out loud funny sometimes. But it's also this surprisingly thoughtful story of the power of being a teen girl, the ways that society has shifted in the last 30 years, and what it means to just believe in and to make your own type of powers. So this is another sports book. Yes, field hockey does play a decent part in it. I mean, you're not going to get the, you know, on the field stuff quite as much.
Do you have to enjoy field hockey or even sports to like this book?
No, not at all. No. You just have to like an underdog team that finds a very bizarre way to harness their power.
Who doesn't like an underdog sports story? I mean,
yeah.
And how does this book connect back into the witch trials? Because I heard that it kind of does. Because Danvers was where that
Danvers is
happened.
Where the trials yeah. were. Yeah. So that's how it ties into their town is just, you know, known for that history.
Okay. That was Ride Upon Sticks by Quan Berry, and I've heard of this book before, and this is not technically YA, right? Isn't it adult, but sort of YA crossover, maybe?
Yeah, yeah, it's adult. I would say it's perfect for crossover, though. Readers who otherwise don't read YA, like, this
like
would
me.
Be a good... Yeah.
Yeah,
I mean, this is a great, like, this is what good YA can do. And then for YA readers who are ready for adult books, but don't necessarily want what they perceive as, you know, capital A adult books, like, this is great.
Yeah. And most of the YA books I do read tend to be the crossover types. Okay, book you did not love.
Just one. Like,
yeah, I know, right? You know, you can tell me more because this is my listener's favorite category. And it's also most of my guests' least favorite category.
Oh, I'm just going to pick one.
Okay.
In part because I've been reading so long and I've really come to figure out like what does work for me and what doesn't work for me that I read fewer books that I don't like now because like I just kind of know. But the one that came immediately to mind is Simon versus the Homo Sapiens Agenda by Becky Albertalli, which I loved Becky's other books, but this particular one did nothing for me. And it's funny to say because so many readers love this book and they believe it to be Becky's best or their favorite. But for me as a reader, it just did not do the same thing that her books like Leah on the Offbeat did or her collaboration with Aisha Saeed, Yes, No, Maybe So did. And I don't know, I can't even tell you like why I just didn't love it, but I didn't. And it's one of those situations where I keep my mouth shut because I know how much the book means to many other people and that's their right to love it that way. And not for me to be like, man, but I didn't like it, you know, like who cares?
Yeah, the Goodreads rating for this was 4.29. That's pretty high.
Yeah.
And I've heard of this one as well. If I've heard of a YA book, it's got to be pretty popular. So.
And like I said, her other books have been so great. Like, I've loved them. This particular one just didn't do it for me.
Just didn't have that X factor.
Yeah, yeah.
That's so interesting how that works out sometimes. I have authors where I'm the same thing. Like, a couple of their books are 5-star books for me, and I've DNF'd some of their other books. So.
Yeah.
All right. That was Simon versus the Homo Sapiens Agenda by Becky Albertalli. Came out in 2015. Tell me about the upcoming release you're excited about.
I am a huge nonfiction reader as well. And so I'm really looking forward to a book called Gory Details by Erica Engelhaupt. And this is science nonfiction, which is something I also just love. And the little blip for the book description says that it blends humor and journalism in the tradition of Mary Roach, investigating the gross, strange, and morbid absurdities of our bodies and our universe, which, like, hello, like all my little boxes are being checked.
Sounds like fun science.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what I love. I love readable nonfiction science books. In high school, I feel like the teachers killed any interest in science I had. But then in college, I signed up for this science book club and we read science nonfiction, and that really changed like my perspective on science. It's like, okay, I don't like science in a lab, but I love reading science like this. And it works for me more for my brain.
It's like these whole like, oh, did you know books where you're reading it, and if you have somebody sitting near you, you're constantly telling them what you've just read.
Yes.
And as I was reading the description for this book, before I even got to the part where they mentioned Mary Roach, I was like, God, this really sounds like Mary Roach. Mm-hmm. All right. So that was Gory Details by Erica Engelhaupt, coming out March 2021. Okay. I'm going to ask you the question I ask every guest right before we close out the episode. And that is, what is the last 5-star book you've read?
Oh, I'm so excited about this one. It's Watch Over Me by Nina LaCour. And it comes out tomorrow, day after we're recording. So by the time you're listening to this podcast,
it'll be out. Yeah.
Yeah. And so Nina's work, I just love. It's this particular book is a story about ghosts and how the scariest ghosts that we ever encounter are our own. And that's this concept that I love thinking about. It's this book is a literary YA about grief and what it means to connect with your past in order to build a path toward a new future. So it features a 19-year-old protagonist who's aged out of the foster care system. And she doesn't go to college, but instead takes this job at a remote farm in Northern California on the coast. And so she is helping at the farm, and she's also working as a teacher for one of the kids who's at this facility. And the farm is filled with ghosts. And so she's trying to discover like what that's all about when she realizes that those ghosts are very, very close to her. So I'm a big horror fan. This is not horror, but ghosts are like my favorite thing because ghosts can be so scary, and they can also be, I don't want to say romantic, but they can be so deeply entwined with ourselves that like they allow us to get to know ourselves more intimately. And this is that kind of story.
And just in time for Halloween, y'all. I know a lot of people like to read ghost and horror and creepy and kind of stuff around this time of year. I am not super into horror or ghost or any of that, but I know a lot of y'all are. Thank you, Kelly. This was so interesting. I have personally been just curious what's been going on in the libraries during this crazy time. And I know my listeners have too. And I know that this was a lot of really fascinating stuff you shared today. So I appreciate you coming on.
Thank you for having me come on. And thank you for having great questions. And thanks to your listeners who submitted some great questions too. If I can leave like any, last, like what
yeah
you can do as a library lover is to really advocate on behalf of libraries, having fair purchasing power, fair rights, fair access to materials. And I'm not sure there's a super easy way to do that except to continue writing to library boards about how important the library is to you, and to write to these companies, these publishers, and let them know like libraries deserve better rates and better terms because they're doing the work that is vital in a community.
And is there an easy way for people to donate to their public libraries privately?
I think that there should be, if there is a link on their website, that would be a great way. But also, your library probably has a Friends of the Library group who runs maybe book sales a couple times a year, or they do other fundraisers. That's a great opportunity as well, because those events help bring money into the library. Some libraries also have their own board. So their own financial board that will help as well. That's different from the Friends group. And they likely work with community partners to help build the budgets of the library. So yeah, just keep an eye on your library's website, their social media, and look for those opportunities.
Awesome. All right, y'all, the September Superlatives episode for patrons will air at the end of the month, and it will include Kelly's picks for categories like favorite book about libraries or set in a library, and the library book she has had on hold the longest. If you'd like to get this bonus episode plus others, you can support the show for $5 a month on Patreon, and there's a link in the show notes and in my Instagram bio. And remember, y'all, we are on the biweekly airing schedule right now. I'm still getting a sense of my time I have available and what my kids' virtual learning is going to look like and whether I can add back in those weekly episodes. But as of now, I can't go there yet.
Mm-hmm.
Biweekly for now. And in 2 weeks, which is October 14th, Eileen Zimmerman, the author of the memoir Smacked, will be joining me to talk about her experience when she discovered her ex-husband had died of a drug overdose and she had not known he was a drug user. Talk to you in 2 weeks. Thanks so much for listening to Sarah's Bookshelves Live. You can find show notes with all the books mentioned in the episode, purchase links, and linked timestamps at www.sarahsbookshelves.com/podcast. And that's Sarah with an H. I'd love to hear your comments, feedback, and suggestions. You can find me online on my blog, sarahsbookshelves.com, on Twitter at Sarah's Shelves, on Instagram at Sarah's Bookshelves, and via email at sarahsbookshelves@gmail.com. And if you'd like to get exclusive bonus episodes of the podcast, you can support us on Patreon at www.patreon.com/sarahsbookshelves. And there's a link in the show notes and in my Instagram bio to my Patreon page. Thanks for listening.